Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin of Code Pink Women for Peace, who examines charges that Saudi Arabia ordered the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the context of the kingdom's gross human rights abuses ignored by successive U.S. administrations over many decades. Michelle Chan of Friends of the Earth, who discusses the new UN report on climate change, which forecasts dire consequences if international action isn't taken to limit an increase in global temperatures. And Nick Abraham of the Yes on 1631 campaign, who talks about a Washington state ballot measure this November that, if approved by voters, would impose a carbon emissions fee on the state's largest polluters. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Brazil's far-right presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro, who was stabbed during the election campaign, is the favorite to win the election to become leader of Latin America's largest nation. Following years of economic austerity and corruption charges against most of Brazil's political parties, Bolsonaro pushed his tough-on-crime rhetoric to win 46% of the vote in the first round of the election. He faces off against Fernando Haddad of the Leftist Workers' Party in the runoff on October 28th. Bolsonaro's Social Liberal Party also made major gains in Congress, raising the possibility that the far right could win a working legislative majority. In his first-round victory speech, Bolsonaro proclaimed his loyalty to family values and warned of an economic downfall in Brazil similar to that of Venezuela. A former army captain who espouses racist and anti-democratic views, Bolsonaro promised to ease restrictions on the sale of guns to battle crime and violence. His emergence has renewed fears of fascism and a new military dictatorship. During the first round of elections, Bolsonaro and his far-right allies easily won Brazil's largest states, Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. In contrast, the Workers' Party, with its lesser-known candidate, won the poor Northeast, with strong support for the party's social policies. Former Workers' Party president Lula da Silva, whom polls showed was favored to win this election, was forced to withdraw after he was sentenced to 12 years in jail on corruption charges, a conviction he's now appealing to a higher court. A week before a critical election in Bosnia, Serbian candidate Milorad Dodik traveled to Russia to meet President Vladimir Putin. There, Putin wished the nationalist Bosnian Serb leader great success. Dodik won the Serb seat in Bosnia's three-member presidency last weekend. The photo with Putin helped galvanize support for Dodik and inflamed ethnic rivalries in the volatile Balkan state. According to the Associated Press, the Bosnian Serb leader is pushing for ethnic separation from Muslims and Croats in Bosnia and is seen as a key Putin ally, working to undermine American and European influence in the Balkans. Meanwhile, pro-Putin populist parties are surging across Eastern Europe. In Latvia, the party favored by the nation's ethnic Russian minority won the most votes in the nation's October 6th election, but political observers expect it will have a difficult time putting together a coalition government. Longtime Orange County, California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher is increasingly implicated in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. election. In mid-September, as President Trump's former campaign chairman Paul Manafort pled guilty to a number of federal crimes, court papers cited Manafort's lobbying of Rohrabacher as part of an illicit scheme. The right-wing congressman, a former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, is now a leading supporter of improving relations with Vladimir Putin's Russia. This fall, Rohrabacher, who has served in Congress for three decades, faces the race of his political life, as polls show him tied with Democrat Harley Ruda in a Republican-leaning district. Rohrabacher, who heads a House subcommittee on Russia, has promoted pro-Kremlin policies, like repeal of the Magnitsky Act, which imposed sanctions on members of Putin's inner circle. According to the Los Angeles Times, Rohrabacher is among the most prominent foes of the consensus among U.S. intelligence agencies that Russian hackers stole digital files from the Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign chair John Podesta. During a trip to Moscow in April 2016, Rohrabacher met with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya and lobbyist Rinat Akhmetshin, who both attended the infamous Trump Tower meeting with Donald Trump Jr. The congressman also met with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in August 2017, when Assange repeated his denial that Russia was involved in the theft and release of Clinton campaign documents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. resident, Washington Post columnist, and a leading critic of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, disappeared on October 2nd after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where he was directed to go to retrieve documents needed to marry his fiancée. The Turkish government says it has audio and video recordings that confirm suspicions that Khashoggi was interrogated and murdered inside the Saudi consulate, with his body dismembered and later removed. Condemnation of the Saudi monarchy has reverberated around the world for what many believe was Saudi de facto leader Mohammed bin Salman's order for Khashoggi's murder. President Trump parroted Saudi denials of responsibility for the murder and dismissed calls for the U.S. to sanction Saudi Arabia, stating that Khashoggi was not a U.S. citizen and that canceling weapon sales to the oil-rich kingdom would cost American jobs. Recent press reports indicate that the Saudi government may soon admit their plan was to abduct Khashoggi and take him back to Saudi Arabia, but that the journalist was accidentally killed during an interrogation. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and author of the book Kingdom of the Unjust: Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. Here she examines charges that Saudi Arabia is responsible for Khashoggi's death in the context of the kingdom's gross human rights abuses ignored by successive U.S. administrations over many decades.
Well, Saudi Arabia has been a repressive country for many decades, but this has gotten worse under Mohammed bin Salman when he came to basically be the one in power because his father, King Salman, is old, has dementia. This is about 3 years ago when he was only 30 years old. He was the one that got Saudi Arabia in the internal affairs in Yemen, causing a catastrophic war. He's been responsible for a crackdown on human rights activists, and he's also been involved in many overseas adventures that have divided the Gulf states, like the economic blockade that he has put on Qatar, the temporary kidnapping of the Prime Minister of Lebanon, and his vicious attacks on Iran. And that is to sort of set the stage, because he's been portrayed in the United States as a great reformer and a liberal, which he is not. So this latest episode, in which a journalist for the Washington Post, a Saudi national but a U.S. resident with children that are American citizens, was told to go to Turkey to get the papers he needed for his divorce so he could remarry. And when he went in, he did not come out alive. And so for the last almost 2 weeks, the Saudi government denied that it knew anything. They said he came in and he came out. Of course, there was no camera footage of him having left, and his fiance had been waiting and waiting and waiting. It looks like now they're going to announce that indeed they did kill him, but it was an accident. It was done by rogue elements in the government, They were supposed to kidnap him and bring him back to Saudi Arabia. Things went badly, and instead he was killed.
Medea, summarize for us a bit about Donald Trump and his administration's response to the allegations against Saudi Arabia for the charge that they murdered this dissident journalist, Jamal Khashoggi.
There has been quite an outcry in the United States, even from very conservative Republican congresspeople like Lindsey Graham, or who said there would be hell to pay, or Marco Rubio, who said we'd have to recalibrate our relations with Saudi Arabia. But from Donald Trump, first it has been silence, then it was downplaying it, then it was saying that, well, no matter what happened, we're not going to want to cut off weapon sales because that's jobs and a lot of money, and that those orders would just go to the Chinese or the Russians. And then he threw out this idea of maybe it was a rogue element, which really set the stage for what the Saudis are going to make up now as their excuse. So all along, he's been trying to either make this story go away or cover it up.
Medea, in your view, what is the proper response of the United States here to what almost certainly was the death of this journalist, Jamal Khashoggi? What should the United States be doing here?
They should certainly be cutting off not only all weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, but immediately stop aiding and abetting the Saudis in the horrendous war in Yemen. They should impose sanctions on anybody who is involved in this heinous act of killing the journalist. They should stop intelligence cooperation with the Saudis. And I think then there's also an issue about businesses, and businesses really should sever their ties, particularly those businesses that are hired to be foreign agents of the Saudi government, and there are over two dozen of them. And then there's also the responsibility of the think tanks, the universities in the United States that receive Saudi money, and the high-tech companies that have been courting large investments from the Saudis. All of these kind of connections really need to be rethought. And then on the larger issue, what really would be the positive silver lining that could possibly come from all of this is a rethinking of U.S. policy that has been one that is focused on the interests of Saudi Arabia and Israel instead of the United States, and has dragged the United States into wars it shouldn't be in, put the United States on a collision course with Iran that is hurting many Iranians because of the draconian sanctions, but could also lead us to another war there. So I think with the American public now having somewhat of an understanding of how repressive Saudi Arabia is, perhaps it is a moment when we could create some distance between U.S. policy and the interests of the Saudi government.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and author of the book Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. Learn more about Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and war crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a sobering report released by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, on October 8th, the world's leading climate scientists issued a dire warning that the nations of the world have only a 10 to 12-year window to take action to limit an increase in global temperatures below 1.5 degrees centigrade. The report concludes that an increase beyond 1.5 degrees will substantially increase the likelihood of disastrous drought, wildfires, crop failures, flooding, extreme weather events, and coral reef destruction. The report lays out the case for urgent international action to limit a rise in global warming, to reduce carbon and greenhouse gas emissions. The recommended measures include increasing the cost of burning fossil fuels, reforestation, changes in land use, moving to electric-powered transport systems, and the adoption of carbon capture technology. Your reporter spoke with Michelle Chan, Friends of the Earth Vice President of Programs, who discusses the warnings and recommendations found in the UN Climate Change Report, as well as the political obstacles in the U.S., where President Trump and the Republican Party that controls all branches of government refuses to acknowledge or take action to address climate change.
In 2015, at the Paris climate talks, countries agreed to a couple of goals. And the first one was to limit the increase in global average temperature to 2 degrees below pre-industrial levels. And then the second goal is to try to stay under 1.5 degrees centigrade. And so this report, which was prepared by hundreds of scientists under the auspices of the IPCC, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this report was done in order to describe how the impacts on Earth and to people would be different between these two different scenarios, 2 degree temperature warming versus 1.5 degrees of warming. And so that was what the report set out to do. And one of the things that the report says is that, you know, even if the world doesn't emit one additional ton of greenhouse gases, even if we were to stop today, that we're already on a path to increasing global average temperatures by 1 degree. And this level, we have to remind ourselves, at this level, people are already suffering and dying because of climate impacts. And then the report goes on to describe what would happen, the difference between 1.5 degrees of warming and 2 degrees of warming. And I can get into a couple of examples if you'd like.
Could you cover for us some of the most dire warnings here that were the consensus of scientists across the world?
Right. Well, they go through a number of different projected impacts between the 1.5 versus 2 degree scenarios. And for example, if we only warm by 1.5 degrees Celsius, then it means that sea level rises won't be as high. And that would mean we could avoid displacing like a million people. So if we went up to 2 degrees, that would mean 10 million people already, you know, would be essentially forced to move. At 1.5 degrees, the science says that we'll lose maybe 70% of our coral reefs instead of 99% of them. So, I mean, 1.5, even though that's the goal the world is shooting for, still is eye-poppingly devastating for the state of our coral reefs and our oceans. But at 1.5 degrees of warming, instead of that 2, we can help prevent what scientists call feedback loops. These feedback loops create runaway climate change. So one example here is that Arctic snow, being white, has the ability to bounce back the sun's rays into space. And the more Arctic snow we lose, then the more the Earth absorbs that heat, and then the more melting is caused, and then there's less snow and less sunlight reflected back. And so that just creates a vicious cycle or a feedback loop. And so the report goes and just chronicles all of these different scenarios, likely scenarios, likely impacts between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And it's very, very sobering, to say the least. It says that technologically, if we go over 1.5 degrees, then we will need to increasingly rely on technologies that suck carbon out of the air. And a lot of these technologies are just completely unproven, and they could be hugely risky.
Well, Michelle, when you look at the advisory here to the world in terms of the dramatic action that will be necessary to stay under that 1.5 degrees centigrade rise in temperature across the world, how realistic is it that that could actually happen in terms of political will, technology, alternative fuel systems, and the like?
Yeah, it's a great question, Scott, because ultimately, Friends of the Earth believes that we need political and not just technological solutions to tackle climate change. This report that the IPCC put out was pretty technological. It didn't seek to really answer the big hairy questions about whether or not, for example, we can get corporations and big oil companies out of our government, as they are blocking us from making these radical transformations in our energy, food, and economic systems that we all need and that the science says we need, right? So it's a really good question about how to tackle this from a political perspective. And that's why, you know, for example, Friends of the Earth has, you know, is working against voter suppression in North Carolina and in other states, because it's the fact that the most marginalized people, the people in this country as well as abroad, that have the most to lose, that have the most at risk, that have the most on the line from the impacts of climate change, are also being politically dispossessed. I mean, that is part of the climate change problem. And it's hard to sometimes to make that fast connection. But I think that all of your listeners, you know that we need to look at climate change from a political lens and not just a technological one.
That was Michelle Chan, Vice President of Programs with Friends of the Earth U.S. Find links to the new UN Climate Report, as well as related analysis and commentary, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The state of Washington is attempting for the second time in 3 years to impose a carbon emissions fee through a statewide initiative this November on the state's largest polluters, like the oil industry and utilities, that have not switched over to clean energy. If approved by the state's voters, it would be the first of its kind in the U.S. The Yes on I-1631 campaign was buoyed by a poll conducted in early October that found 50% approval among 400 registered voters polled, with 36% opposed and 14% undecided. Thus far, opponents have spent $22 million and claim the 1631 ballot measure would cost families hundreds of dollars a year. Supporters, who spent a little more than a third as much at $8 million, say the initiative would cost families only about $10 a month. They say the money raised would be applied to renewable energy and energy efficiency projects that will save consumers money in the long run, while reducing the state's use of fossil fuels and decrease carbon emissions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nick Abraham, communications director with the Yes on 1631 campaign. Here he talks about the history of the fight and what passage would mean for Washington and the U.S. as a whole.
This time around, we have the largest coalition in Washington state history. So, you know, last time they had a pretty small group of folks that decided on a policy that they thought would work best. But, you know, this time around, we are including the largest labor organizations, the largest community of color groups, the, you know, of course, the environmental community, but also, you know, over 250 local businesses, health organizations like the American Lung Association, the Academy of Family Physicians, faith groups like Earth Ministry, and a whole host of cardinals and churches that have endorsed our campaign. So, you know, I think that's what's most inspiring to us and is what been our strongest message with the public, is that we are all on board here. And that's a really powerful juxtaposition to who our opposition with. That is, you know, and the No campaign is 99% funded by six multinational oil companies.
So what does Initiative 1631 actually do?
This initiative would put a carbon fee on the state's largest polluters. Those end up being, you know, the oil industry and utilities that haven't yet switched over to clean energy for the most part. You know, we did not put this cost on the average consumer. We really feel that these companies that are causing the most harm should be the ones to pay this fee. Take that carbon fee and fund it into clean energy projects and bolstering our state's natural resources so that we can clean more of our air and adapt to the changes we know are coming from climate change.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Nick Abraham, but I believe a major factor in the defeat of a carbon price initiative in Washington 2 years ago was the split between the supporters and what's called the environmental justice community, representing low-income folks and people of color who are the ones hurt first and worst by climate impacts.
Yeah, you know, that is generally right. You know, the environmental justice community had a couple of really clear points that we now feel are really well reflected in this initiative. You know, communities of color and low-income folks have been the hardest hit by pollution for decades. And we want to make sure that in whatever solutions we're creating, that they are front and centered in solving that problem. So ensuring that we are investing back in those communities that are hardest hit, that we are not leaving them behind in this transition, and we're ensuring that more people and more communities are included in the clean energy economy and aren't left out, as so many folks have been when we're using coal and oil. The most vulnerable people in our state are the ones who are hardest hit.
The fee is so much smaller than what scientists say is needed to bring down greenhouse gas emissions. If this initiative passes, is it going to do any good or enough good?
This is a very modest first step that we're trying to take here. And, you know, I think we've been delaying for a long time now, and I think folks know that it's time we have to get started with this. But yeah, you know, this fee would start at about $15 a ton. Washington State has pollution reduction goals. You know, we, like so often, our legislature set goals, but with no plan to get there. So we have been missing those targets since 2008. But this fee and investment structure makes sure that we are getting back on track, that we are investing and raising the price $2 a year until we reach those goals in 2035. And once we reach those, there's a cap on the price, and we are just continuing to make those investments so that we can stay on track to reduce pollution. But, you know, the real crux of where we're going to get that pollution reduction, you know, the place we're going to start moving away from oil is through these investments. So investing in things like clean energy, of course, but also, you know, energy efficiency so we can bring down people's electric bills. They just don't have the funds to invest in those things up front. And then again, yeah, really investing in our state's natural resources. So because we know trees in our forests are some of the easiest ways that we can clean the air.
Of course, the opponents say the big polluters will just pass on the cost to consumers.
Yeah, so we know they couldn't pass on all these costs. They wouldn't be spending $20 million of stockholder funding if they thought they could just pass on all these costs. But we know that at a maximum, if they were to pass every penny of this down, it wouldn't cost folks more than $10 to $12 a month for the average household.
Would this be the first effort of its kind in the U.S. if it passes?
Yeah, so this would be the first carbon price in the United States. And I think more importantly, it would be the first major climate pollution policy to ever be passed by a vote of the people. So this is such a big validator to show, yes, people want this. Yes, people are tired of not doing anything on this issue and just continuing to kick the can down the road. This is a huge validator for saying that people want to take action, and they have had a direct vote and opportunity to say that.
That was Nick Abraham, Communications Director with Washington State's Yes on 1631 campaign. Learn more about the Yes on 1631 initiative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.